Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. In one of today's rare areas of bipartisan agreement, people on all sides of our political divide think that too many Americans are incarcerated. Moreover, a significant percentage, estimated at half or more of persons in jails and prisons, have a diagnosed mental illness, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depression. In a vicious cycle, people with mental illness are more likely to be imprisoned, more likely to be left untreated once in jail or prison, and more likely to wind up in solitary confinement, which only adds to the severity of their illnesses. My guest today, journalist Elisa Roth, is an investigator who traveled to the three largest mental health facilities in the United States. Those are Rikers Island in New York, Cook County Jail in Chicago, and L.A. County Jail in Los Angeles. She also spent a significant amount of time reporting in Oklahoma, where our official jails and prisons have a combined 110% occupancy rate, not including our contracted private prisons. Roth shares many individual horror stories in her book and also looks at the macro level about how we got where we are today and what we can do to improve things. Roth has reported for NPR, Marketplace, and been published in the New York Times and New York Review of Books. Elisa Roth, author of Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Health, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Elisa Roth, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start by asking you about something that really surprised me, and I have seen other interviews with you, read, and that is that for a long time, I have, for one, have been operating under the, I think, misconception that when we closed down a lot of this old state mental hospitals, the closure of which goes back to the 1950s, I thought it really wasn't until the 70s that they were closed, but that process started even earlier. There's always, I think, been this assumption that our prison population has grown dramatically in the number of people with mental illness in prisons because of the fact we deinstitutionalize persons. But your research and journalism bears out that that's not exactly, although there is a correlation, they're not necessarily related. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we can go back to the 1930s and 40s. The old asylums and institutions were already overcrowded, really doing a lot more warehousing than treating of people. And there's a lot of records of people who worked in the hospitals, who were patients in the hospitals, talking about these terrible conditions. It wasn't until the 1950s and 60s that we really started closing them down in any great number. And that just accelerated, as you said, into the 70s, 80s. And it still continues today, although the number of beds has gotten so low that you start getting very close to that x-axis. We talk about, as you say, these closings as being the direct cause of the increase in the prison population. And in fact, if you graph the closings of the hospital, so the loss of the beds over time, and you graph the rise in the incarcerated population over time, they do make this nice X. So the number of beds in hospitals is dropping as the number of people in jail and prison is rising. But if we go back and look at who was in the institutions back in the 1950s and 60s, first of all, we have this notion that most people with mental illness were living in institutions, and that's simply not the case. There were a lot of people who were living in them, but there were also a lot of people living in the communities getting treatment such as it was in the communities. So it's not that everybody with mental illness was suddenly let loose with no treatment, because not everybody was being treated in those institutions. And when we look at the population of who was in an institution back in those days, it's a very different population. So the people who were in the psychiatric hospitals were largely white, female, elderly, and diagnosed with schizophrenia. When we look at who's in jail and prison, as you know, it's largely young, male, not white, and the range of diagnoses is much broader. So you see bipolar disorder, you do see schizophrenia, but not the same way that you did in the hospital. So I've seen numbers, like best estimates are that the deinstitutionalization contributed to maybe a 5% rise in the incarceration rate, maybe a little bit more, but it's really not this whole sort of shift of population that we like to imagine.
Yeah, so just right away, that was such an interesting dispelling of, I think, what has largely become a popular myth, at least certainly in the medical community, we tend to think about it that way. There are a very high number of people in jails and prisons who have diagnosable mental illnesses. How high is that?
The best estimates are around 50%. Part of the challenge is that jails and prisons don't keep great statistics on this. And then part of the challenge, which you'll understand coming from the medical side of this, is that how we diagnose mental illness and how we define mental illness is in some measure subjective. So some places will count, let's say, PTSD in their accounting of people with mental illness. Other places will only focus on depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. And so you can end up with this really wide range of accounting. One of the problems that we see is underdiagnosing. And so what you get with the underdiagnosing is then undercounting. So there are some states where this particularly showed up because it wasn't psychiatrists who were doing the diagnosing, or there was a gatekeeper who was some kind of a very low-level healthcare technician or mental health care technician who was deciding whether prisoners would get to see the psychiatrist in order to be diagnosed. And what you saw, not surprisingly, is that they had much, much lower rates of mental illness in the prison, not because the people weren't there, but because they weren't being identified.
Right. And your work on this book and your reporting in general has taken you to, in some ways, the biggest cities in the country, where we have really the largest jails with this significant problem of people with, as you point out, diagnosed and often undiagnosed mental illness. You spend a considerable amount of time talking about, share with us, what are the three, biggest jails in those three big cities? And share with us, if you can, just some broad statistics about how many people are incarcerated there at any one time.
The three largest jails and the three largest providers of psychiatric care in the country are Rikers Island here in New York, the Cook County Jail in Chicago, and the Los Angeles County Jail in L.A. And the number, the populations shift daily, so who's in first place kind of changes around. But really, you can look at almost any county in the country, and the jail is the largest provider of psychiatric care. So that's true in Oklahoma. You see it in Oklahoma City. You see it in Tulsa. And you see it even in smaller cities around the country. So here in New York, I think it's 43-45% of the population has a diagnosed mental illness. I think something like 10% is identified as having a serious mental illness. And here they define serious mental illness as major depression, bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia. And the numbers are roughly similar when you look at the big jails. And they're high, and they're higher when you look at women prisoners. This gets confusing, but the overall population of incarcerated women is much, much lower than the overall population of incarcerated men. But if you're looking strictly at the percentages within those populations, women have much higher rates. So it's something like 75% of incarcerated women have a diagnosed mental illness.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Elisa Roth, who is an independent journalist and has a new book out, the title of which is Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. And Elisa Roth's reporting took her to Oklahoma, among other places, but as she previously mentioned, Rikers Island, Cook County Jail, and L.A. County Jail. How did you get access to these jails? I can't imagine they're that media-friendly.
That would be accurate. In some cases, that would be a very generous way of putting it. but in some places, they honestly were very media-friendly, very welcoming. The Los Angeles County Jail was very generous in its access. And in fact, in both Oklahoma City and in Tulsa, I was given excellent access. There are other places that really are not so keen on having reporters looking at what's going on inside. And I really see this as part of the larger problem. I think that this crisis of people with mental illness behind bars is largely hidden from view. And part of it is that the crisis of mass incarceration, although we talk about it in the news and so on, for a large percentage of the population, it's a world that's completely unknown. And when you sort of subdivide that into the population of people who are incarcerated, people with mental illness who are incarcerated, it's even more closed off. And by keeping reporters out, it just makes it that much more hidden from the public, who is, of course, funding all of this with their tax dollars.
Yeah, and I'm trying to even imagine what it would be like to report in one of these jails? I mean, like, let's say you were, you know, I guess lucky enough to set up a visit at the LA County Jail. I mean, how much time would you plan on spending there? How many days in a row? Or how is access granted? Or how do you set something like that up?
It depends where you are. In most places, the access, even when you get it, is somewhat limited in the sense that you're not going to walk into the jail or the prison and just walk around on the loose by yourself. So it's mediated by somebody in many cases, not always. But I think it would be hard to hide a lot of what's going on there when some place is really dirty or really smelly or the patients are so sick. I mean, the prisoner patients are so sick that they're very, very symptomatic. There's no amount of cleaning up or hiding that's gonna keep that out of view. So I think that even though the access is limited, once you get in, there's a lot to see.
Let's go back for a minute to you talked about the higher proportion of women, even though there's fewer women overall incarcerated, but of women that are incarcerated, a higher percentage of them have a diagnosed mental illness. One of the places that you visited was called Mabel Bassett Correctional Facility, and that's here in Oklahoma. What were some of the things that surprised you or maybe didn't surprise you about Mabel Bassett?
I mean, it was surprising how many people there had mental illness. I think the psychologist there told me that only 10% of the prisoners had not sought some care for their mental illness. It was interesting to learn from her and others there how willing the women were to seek treatment for mental illness. So I think it's interesting to think about why incarcerated women have such high rates of mental illness. Some of it has to do with just that women have more mental illness than men generally. But there are also conditions around their lives, the circumstances of their lives, and then the conditions of their confinement that make them more likely to develop it or to make the mental illness worse. So many, many women who end up in the correctional system have trauma in their lives. They have past histories of physical and or sexual abuse, of being in abusive relationships. So those are all things that make them more likely to have mental illness, more likely for the mental illness to manifest itself. It makes the incarceration much more traumatizing. So things like pat-downs and searches and just sometimes not such nice interactions between the corrections officers and the prisoners can affect that. Then there's the whole issue with children. So many of them have children. Many of them were the primary caretaker, the only guardian of these kids. And when they're arrested, when they're locked up, those kids get taken away. And that, of course, adds to the stress. I mean, we're hearing all these stories now about the separation of families on the border, but this is something that happens in the correction system all the time and has been for years. So you think about somebody who's locked up, who's worrying about who's picking up their child from school or the strain of not being able to see your child for weeks or months at a time. And then in a lot of cases, it proceeds very quickly to terminating parental rights, which means that you're sitting here locked up and your kid is taken away from you for good and there's nothing you can do about it. And so all of this together is really a recipe for making mental illness worse or for triggering it to begin with.
Yeah, or the unraveling, as it were. Right, it just seems like all of it's such a vicious cycle. You also address, and I don't think this is particularly an issue at Mabel Bassett, but several parts of the book you talk about solitary confinement, which is something that's used, that's probably overused in a lot of jails and prisons because of what's purported to be violent behavior or behavior in which someone who's incarcerated might be considered a danger to others or a danger to themselves, and how solitary confinement is so counterproductive and traumatizing in and of itself. I mean, were you able to ascertain really what rates? I mean, do these jails report on how often solitary confinement is used? Are there any reporting obligations for them?
So solitary confinement, as you say, is used very, very widely. I think best estimates are somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 people on any given day are in solitary confinement in jails and prisons across the country. Part of the challenge of understanding how many people are in solitary confinement is that it goes by a number of different names, and the jails and prisons will use different you know, they'll say there are different reasons for putting somebody in solitary. So there's disciplinary segregation, which is you get in trouble and we punish you by putting you in solitary. There's something called administrative segregation, which might fit in the category of, say, a sex offender who would be in danger if he were put into general population. So he's put into solitary for his own protection. There's all sorts of variations on this. And when the jails and prisons report people in it, it's not always obvious that it is solitary confinement. In some cases, the mental health cells are solitary confinement. So if I'm remembering correctly, when you're on suicide watch in Tulsa, you're in a cell by yourself most of the time. So that wouldn't be called solitary confinement. That's suicide watch. But what it amounts to is being in solitary confinement because you're in a room by yourself most of the time. And the psychological effects are absolutely devastating. I've asked around trying to understand how many people in solitary have mental illness. And the answer I get over and over again is we don't really have a way of counting it because oftentimes somebody will go into solitary confinement sane and it will make them insane. So it's a shifting number. And this is something that we've known for literally hundreds of years. We began using solitary confinement in the first modern penitentiary back in the 1800s. And Charles Dickens visited this country in the 1800s and wrote about people going mad in solitary confinement. And the prison there, in fact, quit using it because the officials realized very quickly how terrible it was. And yet we continue to do this. The other piece that's worth talking about is the fact that people with mental illness are more likely to end up in solitary confinement because it's a really common punishment. So there's this vicious cycle of you break a rule, you go to solitary, and then in solitary there's a whole other set of rules, or even the same rules, but you break a rule again and you get more time in solitary confinement, which of course makes you sicker and more likely to break the rules again and so on over and over and over again.
You mentioned the vicious cycle of how if someone comes in without mental illness but is put in solitary, they may in fact lose their sanity, or if they have mental illness to begin with, going into solitary certainly can make that much worse. How do you get out of this cycle? I mean, and you write about people who wind up dying in jails and prisons in solitary or waiting even arraignment or certainly not even getting to the point of a trial. I mean, it just seems like a very sort of disastrously planned system. I mean, it's not really planned, I guess, is what it boils down to.
I think that's the problem. We talk about the failure of the mental health care system, and I think it's a misnomer because there is no system. It's the failure of the mental health care lack of system. So I think it starts in the community where it's so difficult to get treatment and so difficult to access treatment and pay for treatment. And then when people end up in the criminal justice system for whatever reason, we do such a poor job of treating them that they often come out worse than when they went in. And so the solitary confinement is almost like a microcosm of what's happening in this larger system. And I think we really need to look at both how we treat mental health care in this country and how we deal with criminal justice, because this really is part of the larger story of mass incarceration. And if we're going to reform the criminal justice system, we have to look at the mental health care piece of it. But if we're going to fix all of these problems with mental illness in the criminal justice system, we also have to look at how we're treating people, why people are ending up in the system, how they're getting into the system, and how do we get them out of the system before they're in it, if that makes sense. So how do we say, you know, how do we make it so that police officers are taking people to get treated rather than taking them to jail, even if jail is the quicker, easier alternative, quote unquote.
Yeah, and so the last part of your book really is solutions you proffer or recommendations. What are some things that a reader of your book or someone who's listening to this interview who might be interested? Because we seem to be at a moment where, in a rarity in modern times, we seem to have some sort of bipartisan agreement on the fact that we can't incarcerate our way out of this problem. I mean, you give a figure, which I think I've seen elsewhere, that in Oklahoma, for example, we're at 110% capacity in our Department of Corrections. So that is, we have way more people in jails and prisons than we can safely accommodate. And the director of the Department of Corrections has a number of times been quoted in our local media saying that we are, you know, a spark away from some kind of disaster occurring. I mean, how can people get more involved?
I should add that the Oklahoma prisons would be even more over capacity if there wasn't this practice of renting out space in private prisons and so on. So there's this very, it's not even a safety valve, but there are people who've been moved out. But if you actually had all the incarcerated people in the state prison system, it would be at even more over capacity. I think it starts with more mental health care in the community so that people aren't deteriorating in the community. We stop treating mental illness as a crisis and treat it as the chronic disease that it is. We don't treat diabetes this way. We don't treat heart disease this way. Why do we treat mental illness only when it becomes a crisis? But when we start talking about the criminal justice system, I think that starts with the police and really understanding that there needs to be an alternative to jail. If you've ever taken somebody to the emergency room, you know that you can sit there for hours or even days waiting to be seen, waiting to get the person admitted. And so for police, jail is often a much quicker alternative, but it sets people off on this path, gets them caught up in the whole jail and prison piece of this. There are some cities that have done a really good job of both training police how to respond to people with mental illness, but also finding places for the police to take people in crisis. Oklahoma does have a couple of crisis centers, but they're not necessarily the automatic response for a police officer who picks somebody up.
Yeah, you wrote about the crisis center in Norman.
Yes.
And some of the issues there.
This is a place where people can go if they're in crisis, but it's both. What people told me there is that people end up there often because of the failure of the larger community mental health care system. So they're showing up there because they needed a refill on their prescription. They needed to see a doctor to get the refill, but the wait was so long at the community level that they either come straight to the crisis center or they deteriorate to the point where it is a crisis and that's where they end up. In some places, there are more local crisis centers that are really designed for police to bring a person in crisis and they find on the street, let's say, rather than taking them to jail. But there also needs to be a way that if somebody ends up getting arrested, that there's a way to get them out of the system before it's too late, because the further you get in, the harder it is to extricate. So if we can, you know, get somebody out right after arraignment, if it's very obvious that this person is sick and doesn't need to be in the criminal justice system, and particularly when you're talking about sort of low-level quality of life crimes, there's really no reason for somebody to go to jail for sleeping on the sidewalk or yelling at a stop sign or whatever it is. But there needs to be a system in place so that the person can be diverted out of the system. And then I think the last piece is that for people who miss all of those sort of off-ramps and end up in the prison system anyway, there needs to be more and better health care. So there can't be a shortage of beds within the prison system. The caveat to that is that we don't want to make the jails and prisons, they already are the de facto mental health care providers, but you don't want it to be the first line mental health care providers. In other words, you don't want judges and lawyers saying, well, yes, we really should lock this person up because that's the only way he's going to get treatment.
Alisa, I'm wondering, what led you to this line of inquiry? I mean, to do research on both our incarceration issue in the United States, but also mental health treatment or lack thereof in the system. How did you start going down this road?
I have been interested in the criminal justice system for a long time, and I was doing a lot of reporting on it and kept coming back to the mental illness piece of it, which wasn't getting talked about very much. So we talk about race, we're starting to talk about the role of poverty, but we weren't talking that much about mental illness in the context of the criminal justice system. And I was traveling around the country, like really all over the place, and seeing these same issues all over the place, manifesting at different points in the criminal justice system and in different cities and counties. And I realized that this was really a national crisis that's playing out at a very local level. And so because the criminal justice system is so fragmented, you weren't really seeing this larger picture that what's happening in New York is happening in Chicago, but it's also happening in Tulsa, it's happening in San Antonio, it's happening in Phoenix, Arizona. But you somehow, if you're not looking at all of those places, it's hard to connect the dots and see that it's really the same problem just playing out with slightly different local variations. And I really wanted to tell that story because I think it's so important. So we just, most people don't know this is happening and don't know that these injustices are happening.
Yeah, I mean, it winds up being such a powerful investigation and powerful reporting work. I mean, because you've gone into these places that I imagine are just so challenging just to be in or to work in or I mean, obviously to be incarcerated in. And, you know, even as a reporter, you're there, as you mentioned, for kind of a short stint or not going into the, you know, certain places would be off limits to you. But just, I mean, the sights, the smells, of course, which you write about in detail and, you know, just the noise. And how in such an environment, I mean, any type of therapeutic alliance or, you know, any type of therapeutic environment could be engendered. I mean, we talk about like doctor-patient relationship. And I mean, the mental health that's going on in these jails and prisons, I mean, it's almost very transactional. I mean, it's not, there is no therapy really, right? It's, I mean, it's a medication check. It's a quick assessment. It's often a triage to possibly a different location. So, I mean, it just seems like without any kind of dramatic systematic change, I don't see how this really gets better. That's the part I'm left with feeling kind of very sad about.
I agree. And I think, I mean, I think transactional is a really good way to describe it. I think in some cases it's sort of mechanical. It's like checking off boxes. How are you feeling today? You're okay? Okay, great. I think what's hopeful to me is that just about everybody I talk to agreed that the status quo is not working. So you talked earlier about this bipartisan agreement that that we can't incarcerate our way out of whatever societal ills we're trying to fix by locking people up. But I think there's even beyond bipartisan, I think it just goes sort of across the board. Everybody agrees that what we're doing isn't working, that it's wrong. But the harder part is trying to figure out how do we fix it. I think we need to think about where we're investing our money. We've been for a very, very long time, I mean, really since the start of our history, willing to invest money in the name of public safety. We're less excited about investing money in healthcare generally, but particularly in preventative medicine. And I think that mental health care is exhibit A for the ways that we say, well, we don't want to fund a community clinic. Why would I do that? But, oh, I'm happy to pay for this brand new, very expensive jail or prison. And we see that, unfortunately, in a lot of places. They're saying, well, we're going to take all this money and build a beautiful new mental health unit inside the jail or inside the prison. And it's not that it's not needed there, but one has to wonder what the world would look like if we took all of that money or some of that money and invested it on the front end instead of on the back end.
Well, if you like investigative journalism and you like reading compelling nonfiction, I strongly recommend this new book by my guest today, Elisa Roth. It's called Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Elisa Roth, thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.